Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Shadows of the Night Zone. This is Live Events. In the dead of night, when thy winter wounds shall not be healed from the wind which howls about your being. In the dead of night, when your friends have gone, and you sit huddled by the castle's fire. In the dead of night, when all is dark, who will you be tonight? The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, Caveat Emptor, ladies and gentlemen, the host, Colin Knott.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madam and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition of Night Zone Radio. I'm your host, Colin Knight.
Alien abductions.
To the people who had close encounters with aliens, it's no joking matter. Aliens want something. The question is, what? Tonight, in the shadows of the Night Zone, we bring you a special report, a first-person alien abduction story from a man who has made it his life's work to educate and inform others who have yet to experience. Alien abduction, first person, with our special guest, Ed Foco.
These guys said it passed like 2,000 feet above, just off the left side by a mile.
Really?
Yeah, they said it looked like an aircraft with a light in the front and a green trail in the back.
Wow.
Not much question at all, but there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone. All so true. So I happen to be privileged enough to have been on the fact that we have been visited on this planet, and the UFO phenomenon is real, although it's been covered up by governments for quite a long time.
Welcome to the Shadows of the Night Zone, your host, Colin Knight.
And before we get to our guest, Ed Foco, late-breaking news from Chino, California. Chino, California, federal penitentiary, by the way. Former Charles Manson follower Leslie Van Houten has been denied parole in the La Bianca
Charlie Manson, dead man walking.
Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better. Then when I felt like I really offered society something.
Welcome to
Charlie Manson. There goes a name that goes back a ways. He'll never see the light of day, at least I would hope not. I wonder if they've extradited Polanski yet for that rape conviction that they claim he has. And poor Cindy Lohan, yeah, she got 90 days rehab, slap on the wrist. Apparently the alcohol detector that she claims somebody spilled a drink on definitely detected alcohol in her system. She's going to rehab. Big shout out to the Southeast Bricklayers' better half. It's the journey, not the destination, which is special. Remember that. And of course, my shout out for goodwill and peace to a newfound friend in Calgary. It has suddenly become a very interesting pool which you swim in. To the deer feeder in BC, quit it. They only want one thing, and that isn't what you think. And Roger in Fort Worth, page me when you get into Calgary, dude. Let's have a wobbly pop. And yes, the world-famous Calgary Stampede is upon us, the greatest outdoor show on earth, July the 9th to the 18th, a moment in time where a city of over a million people become the wild, wild west once again, when morality is a mere suggestion. Special welcome to old friend from Lethbridge, although a southerner, a fellow Brit. Now, where on earth did I put my Zorro mask? Wink and a nod to Scotland's bravest flower. This is going to cost you. And last but not least, to all listeners around the world on delayed broadcast, welcome to the Shadows of the Night Zone. We will open the phone lines tonight for audience guest participation. We'll do that round about the bottom of the hour. Please keep your questions short, as we do have a lot to get through tonight. Set up your speed dial, 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. Tonight, I'm very, very pleased to have been able to snag Mr. Ed Folco. Thanks to Sabrina at sabrinasunseyan.com and, of course, thecosmicseed.com. We shall be looking into the reality of alien abductions and how truth is weaved into fiction. An explanation from someone who was subject to an alien intrusion, Mr. Ed Folco. Good evening, Ed. Welcome to the Night Zone, sir.
Good evening. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. To clear up the decks, for the setup for the show, Ed, tonight's discussion, you write under the pen name of Henry Edward Webster. Am I correct?
Right. Yeah, I wrote trilogy, a science fiction trilogy called The Cosmic Seed. And it was written in, in three parts, and I also wrote a companion novel to it, which actually carries a lot of, most of it is drawings of the aliens, drawings of the ships, and background information on what went into the story. It was one of those things like when you write a science fiction story, when you write any story, there's so much extra information that goes in that you don't ever see, that I thought that at least some of this information should be put down in the companion novel. I have that fourth novel, and when you buy the trilogy, when you buy all three volumes, you get the companion novel too. So
your trilogy of books, this is a first person fictional sci-fi encounter, right?
Yes, that's why I wrote it under the pen name of Henry Edward Webster, because basically Henry tells you his story, and he is an abductee, and he doesn't realize that until he is finally abducted early in the very first story. And then you begin to learn who he is and what kind of experiment they're going to put on him. And the rest of the story is his encounter with all of those humans and aliens and other people throughout the entire universe that are involved in this experiment. And so you get a chance to see a lot of different things in my particular story. And that's one of the reasons it took so long to write it.
Yeah, no doubt. So Henry Edward Webster is based on an incident and experiences that began around about 11 years old for you. This story to formulate began right there.
The story actually formulated in the head of myself when I was 11. I was attending a barbecue with a bunch of other 11 years old, and we witnessed a UFO, and we had about a 45-minute time missing. And after that experience, this idea of the cosmic seed just came into my mind. And, of course, at 11 years old, you're not old enough to be able to really, put this down. And I really nurtured it all the way through high school. I was interested in UFOs. I was interested in a lot of things and continued to nurture this. And one of the things that affected me a lot the very next day after this UFO is the government began to deny that there was anything in the sky other than some lights. And I had a very, very close up. I mean, this thing was, 25, 30 feet over my head, and I wasn't the only one that saw it. And we knew what we saw. And the government was suddenly saying, oh, no, there was nothing there. It was just a plane, the lights in the sky. And I go, wait a minute. And one of those things that made me skeptical of my government and throughout the rest of my life, basically, I spent studying government. I have a degree in political science from Cal State LA, and I've always been very interested in government because I recognized right away that the government wasn't necessarily telling us the truth. They were telling us what they want us to know and what we wanted to hear. And we don't want to hear that there's aliens floating around our planet abducting people. Yeah. Human beings don't want to hear that. So the government is covering up, and I recognize that, and it really kind of guided me throughout my entire education. I still today stay heavily involved in politics. My story the cosmic seed is you're in the office with the President of the United States and cabinet members discussing the story, basically. So you get a chance to see how I think the government would respond to aliens that were really coming.
And for those people out there that can hit a web search, go to thecosmicseed.com,
right,
and you'll kind of get be able to flesh out a little bit of where we're
yeah,
dancing
can,
because
yeah,
if you haven't read the information yet, it's kind of you kind of get lost in the story. So
yeah, each one of the books is described there, and you'll get there's some pictures of some aliens, and you can go to the alien gallery and get a little bit of background information on each one
exactly.
of the aliens that is in the story. So they're updating my website still. There's some things yet that they're doing on it. If you want to purchase the trilogy, you probably would be better off just to send me an email and ask for it rather than to try to do it on the website. They haven't quite got the shipping and stuff down on my website.
Okay. All righty. So, we'll get to that toward the end of the show of how we can put all that together. But I have to say, Ed, when your story was first forwarded to me, I was a little skeptical. But when I kind of saw how you used your encounter experience and how you wove it into a fictional tale about an alien abduction, it definitely got my attention. And knowing that there is a thread there made me want to find that thread even more.
Okay. I got this idea in my head that Earth was a planet that was being used by aliens like a laboratory, okay, where everything is part of what they are studying. They're studying all the human beings. They're studying all the animals, all the plants. They're studying the whole solar system. This was the story of the cosmic seed that was popped in my head, that these were not people who were coming here to take over the planet or even to change it very much, although there have been some changes by other aliens in the past and probably still going on today. But they are just here to see what it, just like we would do if we went to another planet and before we landed and decided to invade the planet, to go down there and find out what's going on. Or the same thing scientists do today.
Do you believe they're following a prime directive of no contact? Or
no,
do you think they are so far ahead of us that we mean nothing to them? No threat or otherwise?
I think when you read my story, you'll see that it's not nothing. It's what they look for in all species, the same kind of thing we would look for if we went somewhere. What's the potential? Do we have the potential of being an asset to the rest of the universe, or do we have a potential of being dangerous to the rest of the universe? And those are the kinds of things you want to determine. If it looks like we're going to be dangerous, then they may want to keep us from actually going out into space and involving ourselves. And the human history is a history of violence. I mean, we do not have a good background, and it's one of the things I discuss in my story that the aliens discuss amongst themselves, is that other people out there that are living a happy life on their planet, they don't want us to come out there and disrupt their lives any more than we would want somebody to come here and disrupt our lives. I mean, they've been playing that movie, The Independence Day, on television, where the aliens come down, they want to take over the whole world and destroy everything, how would humans be any different? I mean, are we going to be benevolent when we go to other planets? And it's hard for them to know without actually doing the long research and study and see what human beings are capable of. Are they capable of learning not to be aggressive, to be able to not be prejudiced when they go to a society where their people are totally different, where their culture is different, where their morals are different? Are we tolerant people? Or are we going to say, no, you got to do it our way? I mean, you think about when the Spanish came over to South America, the first thing they did was destroy all the religions and force their religion on all the people that lived down there. I mean, is that what we're going to do when we go to another country, another planet? is go over there and try and force our beliefs on them. You know, that's the kind of thing they're concerned about.
I think we have to give concern that we haven't learned what to do with our own garbage yet. So
I don't believe humans, and I think that's the nature of my stories. Humans really haven't evolved enough to be a part of the rest of the universe, especially a universe where there are advanced people and more evolved species.
Right. So after this event when you were 11 years old,
mm-hmm.
How quickly did the general skeleton of the storyline come to you? And did it feel like you were being manipulated, that information was being given to you? Or was it a gradual learning hunger?
The initial incident gave me pretty much the idea that the planet was a laboratory, and this is what they were trying to do. They were trying to study it. That's kind of where it started with. And then there were, as I began to think about different issues as I grew older and issues came up, more information came to me. One of the things that I don't know why, but in my life, I almost read everything that was nonfiction. I've read actually very few fiction books in my lifetime. Although I did like some of the writers, I read a lot of Hyland when I was younger. But as I got older, I was reading astronomy, I was reading geology, I was reading stuff that was all nonfiction. I would read philosophy and politics and government and civics which was all real nonfiction stuff. And all of this kind of began to make sense. I began to realize that that this story began to formulate around how government would react if there were aliens coming down here, and rather than the way that we were reacting to it by denying it, and what if is my story? What if they couldn't deny it? What if there was a space station around Jupiter and everybody knew about it? Okay, now what are you going to do? You can't say, well, who put it up there? What's it all about? And that's kind of where I break my story from what's going on today in the real world. Is I make it so they can't deny it. They have to come out and say, okay, there's something there. And this is, you know, this is what we know. And so my story is able to force government to recognize that there are other people beyond this planet, and they have influence here. And so what is that influence? And how are we going to respond to it? And that's what my first book is pretty much about. And the second story goes into something that as I grew up, I used to have these, and I still have these, what you would call vivid dreams. I don't know if you've had anybody on your show ever talk about a vivid dream, but a vivid dream is one where you actually believe that you're awake. You don't think you're sleeping. And everything's in color, and you're talking to people that you know, and you're going places that you know, and you're so sure you're awake that when you wake up, you're, oh my God, you're surprised that you actually were asleep. And all of the people that were in that dream, you didn't know who they were, you didn't know where you were, but while you were in the dream, you were sure that you knew where you were and who you were talking to. I got more and more of these as I grew up. I got more and more of these dreams, and they're the ones that kind of told me some of the stories that you'll read in the second and third book. The stories about different worlds, you know, where people can fly and where people can communicate telepathically. And so a lot of telepathic and psychokinetic abilities are in my story, my characters. A lot of the powerful aliens have these abilities. And a lot of these come from actual dreams. Even some of the there's one section in the second book where I talk about past lives, past human lives that I've had here on this planet. And I talk about that. And in the very first chapter of the very first book, I talk about reincarnation as a reality, especially for Henry Webster, who had many lives. And in the second book, he starts reliving some of these lives. And I had dreams of being a Neanderthal going into a cave and killing some people and stealing their food and bringing it back to my own clan, only to have another clan come on to back and attack us and kill us all. And that came from a dream that I had. And so a lot of the stories that I tell in here come from these vivid dreams that I've had. And some of the stories that I didn't tell all of the stories, but I told a lot of them. And that's kind of how the book kind of started to come together. As I began to want to continue to move my characters along and move the story along, all of these dreams came into it, and they all kind of fit in place.
Like a jigsaw puzzle coming into
you know, if I needed a name, you know, if I needed a name, the name came into my head. I used a lot of books that have a lot of old English words that are not used anymore. In my third book, I have a glossary in the back that shows you all of the names I use for different planets or different names of different characters and so forth, and what it really meant in English. And I would go through those, and I would search those names. You know, I say, okay, I got this character. This is a bad character. He's a mean person. He's going to be there. Now, what kind of name can I find for him? What kind of name? And bam, those names would come up. And so there were so many of them that I thought, well, I need to tell everybody all of these names so they know where they come from. I used a lot of names from.
Hold on there, Ed. We're going to take a quick break here because I'm hearing a little bit of garble on your phone line. So what we're going to do is we're just going to reset everything here. And take a quick 2 minutes. Everybody, break time. We'll be right back.
Tonight, in the shadows of the Night Zone, Ed Falco, first person abduction story in the Night Zone.
2012 is kind of the beginning of upheavals in the world rather than the end.
There's not much question at all what there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe. No, for sure.
A very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? God put it there.
Across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours. God that is earthly in these times.
The basic conclusion of my writing has been that those who gave mankind civilization were visitors to Earth from another planet. If I say extraterrestrials, it's a dirty word, but that's what they were.
Go ahead, Mr. President. This is Houston out.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the...
The ancient Sumerian text, just in a very broad overview, basically tell us that these Anunnaki came from space and landed on the Earth in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They began to set up a colony that they called Eden.
You can walk the depths of the deepest ocean or the tops of the highest mountains on this planet of ours, and you are still on planet Earth. I was not. I was on the moon. But rather than a first step for me, it was the last step that I remember most. How lucky can you be? You've just been sitting on God's front porch looking back home.
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com. 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, KVADMTOR, 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. Alien abduction. To the people who had close encounters with aliens, it's no joking matter. Aliens want something. The question is, what? Alien abduction, first person, with our special guest, Ed Falco.
Next.
Your host, Colin Knight.
Now, we do have with us Ed Falco, and hopefully we've cleaned up the lines there, Ed.
Can you hear me now?
Now, Yeah, I can, sir. Now, your original encounter happened in 1955. Now, looking back, that's before Betty Hill. That's a much different time than giving this information today.
Yeah, it really was. In the 50s, I think had I been 25 at that time, it might have made a difference. I might have made a bigger thing of it. Being an 11-year-old, I'd only moved to the city that I only knew the kids for about 6 months that were there.
Right.
I had just moved. I moved to this town when I was 10, and this occurred the next summer when I was 11. And so that the whole so I wasn't really that. These people weren't long-term friends of mine. After that party, I saw them for on and off at schools. Some of them went to different schools, and I saw them just very briefly. And within about 3 or 4 years, they all had moved to different places. So it wasn't like, I had somebody that I could have latched onto and continued to talk about
right.
it.
Right.
And so I was really kind of alone. I had an older brother who didn't believe anything I said. And
well, we looked into 1955, the summer of 55,
mm-hmm.
just out of curiosity, and there was USSR performed a nuclear test.
Uh-huh.
The Bell X-2 rocket plane was taken up for its first powered flight.
Mm-hmm.
The first virus was crystallized. 26 British, October the 26th, British troops occupy Saudi Arabia oil fields.
Okay.
And the world's most powerful aircraft, the USS Saratoga, was launched. It was quite a year. If somebody's watching.
I don't remember the date, but I believe it was either in July or early August that this
right.
happened. And the only paper that really talked about it was the local paper. Which, of course, is out of business now, but they put it in there. And when other people said that in Los Angeles that they said it, the L.A. Times picked it up only to say, well, some people saw lights in the sky kind of thing. And then the next
right.
day it came out, oh, no, it was nothing. People just saw a plane going by or something. And that's when I began to realize, and our local newspaper picked it up a little bit because a lot of people saw it. Because like where I was at in my little city, it was flying pretty low. And if you were out at night, you couldn't really miss it. It was dark.
Now, where in America, Midwest, Northwest?
This was in California.
Okay.
in California in a city called Temple City. Temple City, California. And I don't know whether you could still get copies of the Temple City Times or not, but... That was the newspaper that covered the story.
Interesting.
It was just one of those things because the UFOs had been seen over Washington D.C. and because movies like The Day the Earth Stood Still and Forbidden Planet and were all coming out in the 50s. There was a lot of sci-fi stuff coming out in the 50s.
Right.
There was a big mix of those kinds of businesses that were trying to promote their science fiction movies, so naturally they would say, hey, there's a UFO, and now we've got this new movie, and we want you all to come see it, And so there was those kinds of people out there really pushing something else, as well as really kind of the beginnings of the UFO world, where people began to, mm-hmm. They were still calling them flying saucers. Nobody called them UFOs
right.
then. They called them flying saucers. And that's where all that came from, with Kenneth Arnold's first description of what he saw. It looked like a saucer, he said, flying. So everything was flying saucers.
Exactly. And everything in the 50s, of course, the media was fresh off the World War II. And there was a lot of...
Also Korea. You've got to remember that Korea was in 1950, 51 and 52, 53. So... the war was still there, most of the World War II vets who didn't serve in Korea were a different. They were a different breed of people. My father-in-law was a World War II vet, and that was the one generation of people who when the war was over, they just wanted to go back to work and they didn't want to think about anything else. They didn't really want to talk about what they went through. The Korean War was much smaller in the sense that if it wasn't for movies like MASH, we probably would have forgotten about it, you know. Or the fact that we have enormous problems with North Korea today because we didn't finish that battle there. But at that time, it was, oh, okay, it's over with. Oh, you know, we're all glad. No, 1955, the Korean War was over. And there was no war until Vietnam, which was still, 5 or 8 years away. So
Korea, though,
was enjoying themselves, I think.
Yeah, Korea was the virgin child of the UN. I mean, the UN was still in its infancy as far as its creation is concerned.
Yeah,
it's a Band-Aid fix.
The Soviet Union at that time pulled out of the United Nations, and that's why we were able to go into Korea. And that was the last time they made that mistake, because
So in 1955, you basically sowed the seed of this book, Trilogy.
Yeah, and it took me many years to get the skills to put it all together. In the early 1980s, the stuff was coming at me so fast, I started writing it down. And I discovered that as I began to write down the story, more of it came. And I put down several hundred pages in the early 80s, and then my wife and I, we started a business, and I had to put it aside again. And it wasn't until about the mid-90s that I was able to actually start to put it together as a book and learned how to not only to write a book, but how to publish a book and market a book. I mean, you have to learn everything about when you write. It's not just the creative process. I have a creative mind because I forced myself to have. I've learned over the years how to do that, how to think creatively. But I'm not that great of a writer, so I needed an editor. And, I needed somebody that would make what I was trying to say palatable to somebody who was reading it. I mean, I can tell you something verbally, and you'll understand it because I have emotion, I have gesture.
Exactly.
But you can't do that when you write. Your words have to have that, and it really takes an expert in writing. And so I have to give 100% of my of those people who like my book. I have to give full credit to Trudy McMurrin, who was my editor, and unfortunately she died here last year.
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sorry to hear that. I think everything's balanced again. Every so often, Talk Radio, for some reason and all, it goes absolutely wacko on the audio. So we just wait for the balance there. There we go. I think we're back to square one. It does that every so often. We're not sure why, but it's kind of strange. So let's go back. Let's just go back to when you were 11 years old. Let's flesh out that story, because a couple of people are asking what happened. We've been alluding to the adventure at 11 years old, but we didn't really flesh it out. So how about I open the mic and let you flesh that out?
Okay. If somebody wants to ask a question, I can explain more of it, what happened. Is there somebody answering?
So you were in the yacht.
Yeah, we were in. There was about 8 or 9 11-year-olds that were invited over to this. One guy invited us over to his house to have a barbecue, and there was probably 3 or 4 couples who were adults. And once the barbecue was over, we were all eaten. It was a summer night, so it was pretty warm. The adults all went into the house probably to drink. And we all stayed outside. And what we started to do, back in 1955, we didn't have computers and we didn't have games and cell phones.
Hacky sack.
You played Monopoly or you played Risk, and when it was night and dark, you didn't even do that. What we did was we sat around a circle and started telling ghost stories, trying to scare each other. That's what 11-year-olds do. They want to go see King Kong, or they want to go see a movie that's going to scare them. And so we started telling these ghost stories. And when it came to my turn, I can't remember how I got it, but I had a flashlight with me. And we had turned the lights off. There was a light on the garage, where the barbecue was, and there was kind of a lawn area, and then this guy had a big backyard with a couple of big trees back there, and his back porch, which was a ways away, had a small light on it, and that was the only light that was out there at that particular time. So where we were in this lawn area was actually pretty dark, and I had this flashlight, and I started telling this story about UFOs, because everybody was talking about these movies that were coming out with UFO, and these aliens were going to come down, and they were going to suck our brains out, and it was just, you know, just to try to see how much I could say to scare all these kids. And I had this flashlight, and I flashed it up into the sky like it was supposed to be the flying saucer going around. And I flashed it on what looked like stars. Now, if you know anything about the California skies, you don't see very many stars. But there was a couple of them up there, and I flashed the light on it. And as I had the light on the flash, one of those stars just dropped right out of that. You know, it looked like it was, you know, out in space, but it actually wasn't. Right. And it came down, and it kept coming down, and it kind of floated around. It moved back and forth and kept getting lower and lower and lower, and I kept my flashlight on it. And it hovered.
Now this was kind of dusk, dark. So what? 8:30, 9 o'clock?
Yeah, we're looking around 8:30, 9 o'clock. It's dark out. Okay. There was no moon that I can remember. I don't believe there was any moon, because there was very little. But there was enough light from just that back porch light and from my flashlight. I flashed it right on this thing, and it settled down just slightly over these trees. Now, these trees were about 30 feet high, maybe 25, 30 feet high, and they're great big old trees that this guy had in his backyard. And I had this flashlight under there, and I could see three triangle-shaped protrusions on the bottom of this craft. There was no wing. There was a light
like around. Like landing feet?
They could have been protrusions coming down, but it was just a triangle cutouts. There was a light around it, real thin, and you could see windows, very small. Every once in a while, you could see a window. You couldn't see anything in it, but you could see the light from behind it, and it stayed right over these trees. And a couple of the guys that we were all sitting down on the grass, and I had this thing, and we just started looking at it. You know, we just stopped and looked at this thing. A couple guys started standing up like they were going to get out of there. And then the thing just took straight up. It went straight up and disappeared. Right. And that was when things got really strange, because within 30 seconds, this guy's mother stuck her head out the back door. And she said, "It's almost 10 o'clock. You kids better figure out how you better start getting ready to go home." And we all kind of looked at each other, and I looked around. I still had the flashlight in my hand, and I looked around, and instead of everybody being sitting down, we were all standing up, and we were all kind of looking at each other, you know, and I said, 10 o'clock, you know, I mean, it was just got dark, you know, it couldn't have been, you know, it was only like, I saw the thing for like 2 minutes, 3 minutes maybe.
So nine minutes.
That was like
45 hour.
Minutes ago, you know. Okay. And so we had all lost that time. And I don't think any of us kind of recognized it right away. I kind of felt strange. So we just I was barely able to thank the lady for the barbecue and went home. And then when I got to thinking about it, I go, God, where'd all that time go? You know, we were doing, you know, we were there just 10, 15 minutes, and all of a sudden it's an hour and a half. And so.
And I'm getting flashes from my panel saying, where's all the time going? We do have to take a quick break here, do a reset, and we'll open up the phone lines for all of our people. We're going to call for a 30-minute over, so we've got about 40 minutes or so to talk about the issue. Sure. So hang in there, Ed. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick 2-minute reset. Hang in there.
Okay.
Tonight, in the shadows of the Night Zone, a first-person alien abduction story. Alien abduction, first person, with our special guest, Ed Falco. Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone.
2012 is kind of the beginning of upheavals in the world, rather than the end.
There's not much question at all, but there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe.
Oh, no, for sure.
A very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? God put it there.
Across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours. God, this Earth is in disguise.
The basic conclusion of my writing has been that those who gave mankind civilization were visitors to Earth from another planet. If I say extraterrestrials, it's a dirty word, but that's what they were.
The ancient Sumerian text, just in a very broad overview, basically tell us that these Anunnaki came from space and landed on the Earth in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They began to set up a colony that they called Eden.
Can you be? You've just been sitting on God's front porch looking back home.
You are in the Night Zone on blogtalkradio.com. 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, KVDMTOR 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. Alien abductions.
To the people who had close encounters with aliens, it's no joking matter. Aliens want something. The question is, what? Alien abduction, first person, with our special guest, Ed Foco. Next.
Let the future tell the truth and evaluate each one according to his work and accomplishments. The present is theirs. The future, for which I have really worked,
is mine.
Nikola Tesla, an upcoming show in the Night Zone. Watch for the listings on blogtalkradio.com. Your host, Colin Knight.
Yeah, I think we've pressed enough of the flesh for a while, so that should keep everybody happy. So Ed, when going back to this time lost, did you regain any of that time over the years? Have you managed to reaccumulate that time?
Well, I wrote about the basic story, which I just told you one time, and I put it in an anthology. And Sabrina asked me to do a blog on it, and I did it. There have been some things that I have remembered over the years about what happened. One of the things that I had noticed the very next day was that I had a mark on my leg between my knee and my ankle. It was at that time when I was 11. There was maybe 15 or 20 marks, kind of like in a circle, and they were like little dots, real dots, and they were very, very red. And it's just outside the shin bone, and I, you know, when you're 11 years old, you know what your body looks like, and you know whether you have marks or not. And I never noticed that mark, and the next day, when I was showering, and I saw that mark, and I go, my God, I didn't think I scraped myself or anything like that. It didn't look like that. And later on, I'm not sure whether it was like just a revelation or one of my dreams where I was sitting in this kind of open room, and there was kind of like a white fog on the floor, and I was sitting on a bench, and I looked down the bench, and I could see these same kids that were at this barbecue all sitting kind of next to me, we were actually wearing long pants. We weren't wearing shorts, even though it was summertime. And I had my pants rolled up, and I remember this guy had this. I couldn't really see his face real clear. It was kind of like you were looking at a fog. You know, you ever see these things they do on television now when they're trying to cover somebody's face up so that you can't identify him? Well, his whole body was kind of like that. But he had this syringe with these 15 or 16 holes, and I could see him putting up them against the leg of each one of these kids, and one of these other aliens came to me and said, "Don't worry, it's going to be all right. We're just going to put a little thing inside that, so we can keep track of you. And I go,
right.
Keep track of me? And he goes, yeah. I says, we're just going to keep track of you. Don't worry, it won't hurt. Well, it did hurt. But he put that syringe in, and it was actually painful for a second, and they pushed. I could see it was like a little pellet. It looked like about the shape of a pin, you know, like a straight pin.
Right.
It wasn't really, if it was any thicker, I don't even think it was even thicker than that. It couldn't have been more than about, maybe a quarter of an inch long. And it actually was injected underneath my shin bone, along with some jelly-like material. And then when he pulled the syringe away, they used some sort of cold blast that kind of closed that wound up. And it didn't bleed at all. There was no blood there at all. And that was one of the things that I remembered. And I remember...
And this was the mark, and this was the mark that was on your shin.
Yeah, and it's now after 60 years, 65 years, it's starting to fade a little bit, but you can still see it. A few years ago, one of the other radio talk show guys took a photograph of it, you know, but it's starting to fade now after all these years. But
so going back to when you were 11 years old, were you scared when this thing was hovering over the trees?
Actually, you know, I wasn't, and I wasn't afraid when I was talking to them, they seemed to know that I was going to cooperate with them, and I have always kind of felt that way. Even when there have been at least two occasions, one here not too long ago, but a long time ago, where I'm asleep in my bed and I'm aware that there's somebody else there, and often I would hear in my head saying, "Oh, we're just going to do some tests and it won't take very long," and then it would go away, and I sort of agreed to cooperate, and so I have never been afraid of any of these experiences, and I know that a lot of people are. And I know a lot of people
have a lot of problems with it,
but I never did.
So these wouldn't be considered night terrors. These would be, which would be a causality of why some people, and I say some people because, you know, we have a hard time pinning down the goings-on of the mind. And a lot of times people think they're clairvoyant, for instance, when they're really not.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
too. These are things actually I haven't talked a lot about because most people will say, well, anybody can make that up, and they're right, you could, and so it's kind of hard to actually talk about them. I do talk about one incident in my story in my book that I actually happened to me where I was asleep, and I felt something brush up against my arm, and it was kind of like a reflex action. I just reached with both hands as hard as I could, and I grabbed a hold of it, and I realized I had an arm in my hands, both hands, and I was gripping as hard as I could, but I couldn't open my eyes. I couldn't wake up, and I just kept gripping as hard as I could and hard as I could, and I could feel the arm that I was holding kind of give way, like it had cracked, and I didn't hear any sound. Nobody yelled or anything like that. And I kept hearing in my head, it's okay, it's okay, let go, let go. I hear it's okay, it's okay. And finally my arms just gave out. And I still couldn't open my eyes. And I fell back to sleep. And when I woke up the next morning, both of my arms were so sore because I had gripped so hard.
Right.
And that I put in the story, I tell that story in mind. So those are the kinds of things. There's a lot of things that actually happened to me in real life that I put into the story, and there are things that I, you know, you have to, because it's a science fiction story, you have to kind of add a little bit to it. So
some of those
dreams I put in there.
And that's one of the things that I enjoyed about the trilogy, to be honest with you, is as I said at the top of the show, the way you threaded reality of issues that have come through your mind into the fictional work that is palatable.
Right.
And I do like the twist, because no matter how you get the information out, Ed, the fact is you are getting the information out. And that's
kind
what's
of what
important.
I felt about, you know. And, you know, it just, it flowed. The information would flow. I would hit a point, and you know how a lot of writers talk about, gee, you know, I got writer's block, I can't seem to think of anything. I never had that problem. The ideas just kept flowing. If I was writing about something, I wrote about one time, I wrote about a past life of Henry Webster's past life as a cowboy, quick draw artist, and I read about, you know, and I read about six or seven books on Western culture in order to write this two paragraphs within this story.
Exactly.
And that's, I think by doing that, I just never had writer's block. I mean, I finally got enough. See, I didn't know a lot about the Western world, so I had to learn. And I learned just enough to be able to, that story just poured right out of me. And that, again, came from a dream that I had. It's a little different than the story I tell in the book as... did I send you my trilogy?
I did get a copy. I don't know where it came from, to be honest with you, Ed, but I did get a copy of the book.
Because I was told to sell them out. If you read the very first chapter, where the guys are in the Philippines in World War II, the very, very, very first chapter of the book called
Reincarnation. Now that's based on you being at Clark
I was actually stationed there, yes. I was stationed at Clark Field. I was on that hill. That hill at that time in World War II had a radar bubble on it. When I was there in the 60s, early 60s, I was there. It had just an office building that I worked at. And there were still mortars on that hill that were live, because while I was there, I was there 9 months, and while I was there, they took three of them off the side of the hill right there that had were there since World War II. So that was not the story itself that I told wasn't a true story, but it was a true incident. That's a real place. It's something that really happened. That base was overrun by the Japanese, and there were people that were killed on it. And there was a Negrito native village up in the mountains above there. Because when I was there, we went up to the village, and I got a chance to meet the Negrito chief. I don't know how much you know about the World War II history in the Philippines. They were enormously helpful to the resistance movement in the Philippines until MacArthur came back. Landed there, and they were given a special privilege by the Filipino government as a result of that efforts that they did, and they were really different people. The Negrito native is not really a Filipino. He's much more like an Aborigine from Australia. They were little people, and
I have a good friend of mine that owns some property in the Philippines. Unfortunately, it's under about 15 feet of ash.
Was it in the 70s or 80s? The volcano, they've abandoned Clark Field now. I guess they've opened up, someone told me they opened up parts of it again. Right. But most of it got covered. Subic Bay got covered. And America basically abandoned the Philippines as a result of that. So it's a slice of history that's not going to ever be again. You know, I have no idea how the Negrito native is doing there. I do know that they are a different class of people. They apparently have, the Filipinos have actually no authority over them whatsoever. And a Negrito native can kill a Filipino just because he doesn't like him, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. And so they when I was there, the Filipinos would actually cross the street if they saw a Negrito coming down the street, because these guys were, you know, they would be walking there with spears or knives in their hands and so forth. Right. And
you made a very good point earlier regarding somebody looking at Earth and watching what we're doing, if you will. We can't even get along with each other. How are we supposed to get on with other planets and other universes and other culture. We can't even do it.
Yeah, in my story, I talk about that too. One of the different types of people that humans are that creates this chaos that we continue to have. I mean, when I was in college, I had this book called A War Through History, and it started from the beginning of time and it stopped right after World War II. And there was never a period of longer than maybe 15 years where there wasn't a war going on someplace in the world. I mean, this is not a peaceful planet. This is a very and here we are. We had World War II. We had Korea, and we jumped right into Vietnam. We jumped right into these other wars, and even the wars that we weren't participating in. There was a bunch of wars over in Africa and Asia that have continued to go on, and they call them civil wars, but there were right. really slaughters, of one group of one race, or one culture, or one religion on top of another, and continual fighting. I mean, the Palestinian Israeli thing has been going on for 1,000 years, and the continuing conflict between various religions and various cultures has never stopped. This is not a planet that, if you were studying it from the outside, looking at it objectively, which is what I tried to do when I wrote this story, to try to say, okay, I don't want to be sympathetic to humans. I want to look at it objectively. You look at it objectively, and we don't come out very favorably. I mean, you're looking right. at like, yeah, I don't really know if I want, more than about 4 or 5 humans going anywhere, because you put hundreds of thousands of them together, and they need to live on a planet because their planet is going to go nova pretty soon. They're going to be just pushing people out of the way, survival of the fittest kind of thing,
Right.
And that's one of the themes of my story, is that Earth, in order for the human species to survive, it has to get off of this planet and get to another planet before our sun goes nova, or before some extraterrestrial thing, a planet or another meteor or something, destroys life here. You've got to get someplace else, and you've got to take all 6 billion people with you, because you can't right. just move 50 or 60 people and try to start a new civilization. It won't work. You've got to have enough gene pool to be able to create a society. You have to have millions of people in order to do that. If you do it with 50 or 60 or 70 people, you'll interbreed so much that you'll basically cease to produce offspring. So you have to be able to move all of these people. Well, where are we getting the technology to be able to move billions of people? And we have to move them, minimum 4.5 light years. That's our nearest star, because that's our nearest solar system. It's 4.5 light years away. How fast can you travel, We can't even right. travel fast enough to get there. And then we don't even know if we're going to find a planet like ours that we could live on that nobody else is living on. And, of course, if you find a planet like this, there's obviously going to be life on it of some sort. And now how are we going to handle that? Are we just going to say, well, we got no choice? There is an alternative, and I give that alternative in my story also, is to be able to convert planets. If you have the technology to take a planet like Mars or a planet like Venus and convert it to an Earth-like planet, yeah, then you have a chance. Then you have a chance of going someplace where there's nobody on it, and then you can create it. But where are you getting this technology? Are we working towards it? If someone said we've got 10,000 years to get off of this planet, that isn't enough time to be able to learn all the things we need to learn and then move 6 billion people. There isn't enough time to do that.
It wouldn't be enough time if they made us dig up all of our garbage and take it with us. I most certainly agree with you there.
That's the other thing. We really need to be able to get rid of our garbage.
Yeah, we haven't learned anything. We really haven't, We're the only animal on the planet that, defecates in the same area that they eat. I mean, it's ludicrous, It's crazy. Tell you what a great way to take a segue, Ed. We're going to take a quick break. 2 minutes, everybody, and we'll go another 30 minutes tonight, Blog Talk Down the Line. Everybody be aware, we are dropping the line 30 more minutes.
Okay.
I have that prerogative. Right back.
You are in the Night Zone on BlogTalkRadio.com. Are your doors locked? Are your windows secured? Are you alone? Are you sure? Hold on tight. You are entering the shadows of the Night Zone. Tonight, in the shadows of the Night Zone, a first-person alien abduction story. Alien abduction, first person, with our special guest. Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone.
2012 is kind of the beginning of upheavals in the world, rather than the end.
Minds immeasurably superior to ours. God, it is the Indian.
The basic conclusion of my writing has been that those who gave mankind civilization were visitors who earthed from another planet. If I say extraterrestrials, it's a dirty word, but that's what they were.
The ancient Sumerian text, just in a very broad overview, basically tell us that these Anunnaki came from space and landed on the Earth in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They began to set up a colony that they called Eden.
347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or host. We remind all of our listeners, KVADMTOR, 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. Alien abductions.
To the people who had close encounters with aliens, it's no joking matter. Aliens want something. The question is, what? Alien abduction, first person, with our special guest, Ed Foco.
Next.
Let the future tell the truth and evaluate each one according to his work and accomplishments. The present is theirs. The future, for which I have really worked, is mine.
Nikola Tesla, an upcoming show in the Night Zone. Watch for the listings on blogtalkradio.com. Your host, Colin Knight.
And we have with us tonight Ed Foco, and we're talking about the first-person encounter with aliens when he was 11 years old, and the books that had been attributed from that planted seed, if you will. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fair to say, Ed, that has come from those seeds to create the Cosmic Seed, the trilogy. Great bunch of books. So, during your personal experiences, Ed, have you ever been approached by any government agency?
No. They have not ever said anything to me. I've never been involved with I've talked to people who have talked to the Men in Black. Back in somewhere in the mid '80s, there was a craft that crashed in Sedona, Arizona, and I went up there about a week or so later, just on a kind of like a vacation thing, and I talked to a lady that worked in one of the shops that actually saw the craft, and actually talked to one of the soldiers that was picking the thing up and taking it away, and the soldier made the remark to her that it's another one of these things that crashed, and he got pulled away by somebody of higher rank and told him to shut up. And the next day, she said that these two guys in black suits came into her shop and wanted to know what she saw, And when she looked them right in the eye and says, "I didn't see anything," because they don't want any trouble, These people will hound you, If you say, "Well, I took pictures," they take the pictures from you, Who'd you tell? You got to go over to that, and then they'll tell that person to keep their mouth. So they just say. She said, "I didn't say anything," and I just heard about it from other people. And so
why do you think that the government are keeping a lid on this?
I think that was one of our craft. One of the things that the government has been working on is this electromagnetic engine, this electromagnetic pulse engine, because it's very powerful. I mean, it can go very fast. Unfortunately, it does have some weaknesses, and one of the weaknesses is if it gets into an electrical storm or a high-energy area, like Sedona has a lot of high energy because of the rock formations there, it just shuts the engine down. And the thing, it doesn't have wings, so it just drops right out of the sky like a helicopter whose engines have been turned off. And right. That's why the Aurora, which is their new one, is shaped more like a long time ago they had this airplane that they were making called the Flying Wing. You probably have seen
that. The Boomerang.
Yeah, the boomerang-shaped thing. And it wasn't very maneuverable, but it didn't crash. So I think what they've done is they've taken this electronic pulse engine and they've put it into a triangle-shaped thing, so if the engine goes out, the thing can stay afloat in the air, and they can use a conventional engine to keep the thing from crashing. Because there hasn't been, the 80s is about the last time I heard of any crashes of test vehicles that our government has. And the government has reason not to let on that they have this this Aurora, although there's a lot of evidence now. There's guys across the country that have equipment that measures these sound barriers that come across them, and they have measured the speed of the Aurora from one end of this country to the other at about 8,000 miles per hour. So they know that they've got a ship going that fast. And the reason they have a ship that goes that fast is because it can outrun the surface-to-air missiles and the air-to-air missiles. So if you shoot a missile at this plane, he can just simply outrun you. And that's why they've got it. The problem with the Aurora, and one of the reasons it's been around long enough, I think they probably could have had it gone public with it, but the problem is that it's running about $2 billion a piece. And they just, if someone says, well, we're going to make 100 of them, or 50 of them, where are we going to get all this money? We're already broke. So,
but wouldn't an EMP just take them out? An electromagnetic pulse, wouldn't that just take out?
Well, see, that's the thing. Once the electronic pulse, see, if you had if they go through an electrical storm, or even if they fly high enough to get in, there's a lot of energy out in when you get beyond our atmosphere. There's a lot of static electricity up there and other energy. Right. But they have a conventional engine too, so that when the pulse engine goes out, they can crank over to the other engine and keep the thing afloat. It can't go as fast as the pulse engine can go. I mean, a pulse engine can really put 8,000 miles an hour. I mean, that's a lot of push for a metal ship. I don't care what it's made out of. That's a lot of G's for the guys that are riding in it.
Yeah. That's also a lot of wasted energy when, that they're literally they're fighting against gravity.
I think,
again, it's the thinking outside of the box mentality that I come about.
Yeah.
And are there anyone out there working on anti-gravity?
That's the problem. That's what we need. See, anti-gravity is really the answer because gravity, you don't need to put a bunch of liquid fuel into a gas tank in order to make it run. You actually pull the gravity through the. And you can go out into space because gravity is everywhere. So that's the gravity anti-gravity engine is where space travel comes in. I mean, you're not really going to go anywhere at any kind of speed until you have an anti-gravity. And and it's different than an internal combustion engine or an engine which burns fuel, because it doesn't burn gravity. It actually just pulls gravity through it, and by doing it, it creates thrust. And no one's been able to figure out how to do that. They do know, gravity, is that somebody calling in? If you look at gravity, gravity is a very weak force relative to other forces in nature. But it also is very much like water in the sense that water is very soft. You can put your hand in it and so forth, it forms and so forth. But it also can be very powerful, like in the form of a vortex. You look at these black holes where the power of gravity is so powerful it can just suck whole galaxies into it, So that's the advantage of gravity as an anti-gravity anti-gravity engine, is that you can literally pull as much power as you want. It's almost limitless power, and that's the only way you're ever going to be able to travel in space, plus the fact you're going to have to learn how to warp your drive.
Going to have to be a time factor too.
Exactly. There's a time factor. You have to be able to warp. You have to use use wormholes and that sort of thing to shorten your trips, because I mean, at the speed of light, it takes 4.5 years to go someplace. That, you know, you're not going anywhere. I mean, this is that you're not even getting close to the center of our own galaxy, and there are billions of galaxies. I mean, if you're going to travel in space, you have to be able to travel at enormous speeds, and you have to be able to travel very quickly from one place to another. And, you know, Star Trek tried to do a little bit of that in telling us how you might be able to travel from one end to another with a warp drive. And apparently it's possible to do warp drive, except you've got to be able to have the gravity engine to begin with. And if the government's working on it, but the mentality of the military, the reason they did the electromagnetic pulse engine and the reason they want to go 8,000 miles an hour is so that you can't shoot it down. I mean, if you shoot down a B-1 bomber, they lose $1 billion. You know, they don't want you to be able to shoot this thing down. That's why they want it to go so fast. And of course, it's creating an enormous amount of pollution because it's throwing all this liquid out of the back of it as it's traveling at that huge speed. But they don't think about that. They only think about the fact that the ship isn't going to get shot down.
We have a message down in our virtual studio from UFO abductee that gravity is the only thing that all planets have in common. Now,
universe. It's what binds the universe together. Gravity is the one energy that's everywhere. And that's why it has to be the universal way of traveling through the universe. It's because that's the only thing that's everywhere. I mean, there's no fuel that you're ever going to be able to go from planet to planet to put more fuel in your thing and keep it going. And it doesn't work. Now, I noticed in your prenup or your little intro there, you talk about Zachariah Sitchin's story.
God bless him, yes.
Yeah, great stories. If those people out there who haven't read the Earth Chronicles or his latest book, There Were Giants Upon the Earth, those are excellent books to read and get an idea of what happens when there's an alien planet that comes into our solar system, and they were able to use rockets to go back and forth because the distances were so short. And, of course, that's all chronicled in his stories thousands of years ago when they were actually here. And that's a whole – I don't know if you've ever had him on your show. Of course, if you haven't, he's 90 years old, so you better hurry.
He is next to impossible to book, to be honest with you, Ed. The man is so busy for being retired.
He's busier now than
he ever was. So.
Yeah, I met him many years ago at one of the things he actually went to, and he's an extraordinary person, and he's literally dedicated his entire life to this story that he has written, and I use a lot of what he says because that's basically one of the stories in my very first book is the space station around Jupiter that the governments on Earth discover was put there by this planet that's coming back into the solar system. So I use I steal a little bit from him because I think that's probably what's going to happen. And even he has a new book out called The End of Days where he tries to speculate as to when this planet is coming back into our solar system.
Now the speculation, of course, is Planet X on Nibiru, December the 21st, 2012, when the complete alignment is complete, supposedly. Now that's the myth. So, do you believe there's a Planet X and a planet coming to return into our area for?
I call the planet by a different name in my book. It was called a lot of things. Nibiru was one of the things he called it. They also called it in later history. They called it Marduk. And my book, I changed the name because one of the things that about Zachariah Sitchin is he's talking about what human beings called other things, what they called the gods, what they called the ships, what they called the planet, and so forth. In my story, I turn it and say this is what they call themselves. So I changed the name of the planet to Merari. And so that was the way I worked with it. And do I think Merari is coming back? I think it's been coming back. And The difference is now I think that it's been a couple of thousand years since the planet is coming back, and it probably is going to be a long time before it actually is close enough to Earth for us to be able to see. I know that the government has looked for this planet. I know SETI has also looked for this planet, trying to find it, and they haven't been able to. And in my story, I suggest why they haven't been able to. Because in 2,000 years, I believe the people who were on the on this planet, I think they have evolved just like we have evolved, and I think that they're probably have changed their. One of the problems with their planet was every time it went through the solar system, it crashed into something or interfered with something, and it was always a mess. And I think they've finally figured out how to control their planet, and they probably have changed the course of their planet so that it doesn't come in at such an extreme angle, and thus they're not going to be interfered, because they orbit between Mars and Jupiter, and that's the asteroid belt. Well, that's full of rocks, basically. Some of them as big as our moon, you know, and you've got your planet going through that. You know, I mean, you just can't avoid having collisions, especially when you're going in the opposite direction. You know, they're coming in going clockwise, and everything else goes counterclockwise.
And also remember the snooker effect. I mean, the ricochets and where those new planets are heading for.
Yeah, well, even Zachariah Sitchin suggested that the Maru had moons of its own, and those moons would be away from the planet and make the space that they would need even larger. And so I think they've maneuvered their planet now so that they don't have that kind of they don't have that trajectory anymore. And I think that they probably have gone beyond the rocket ships that they used thousands of years ago to land here, and they probably can come here just about any time they want. So I don't really know. I have a different idea for 2012, which I talk about in my story also. What it means, and I don't. The Mayan calendar ended on that date because if I'm not mistaken, it's supposed to be the beginning of one celestial age, and the end of another. What is it? The end of Pisces and the beginning of Aquarius, and that's the winter equinox of 2012, July 20 or December 21st is supposed to be that day. Rather, that makes a difference. In my story, I give another reason for that, but that's just my philosophy, not necessarily what's going to happen. My guess is whatever does happen in 2012, it'll probably be subtle. It probably won't be catastrophic, and it may be 2 or 3 years afterwards we realize that that's actually something that happened. So I don't know, and I don't think anybody else knows either.
So
the Mayan calendar never said what was going to happen. They said it was the end, but they didn't say the end of what. You know,
there are so many riddles in the messages that were left that. For some reason, I still don't understand that. If I know there's going to be an event, I wouldn't decode it in riddles and rhymes. I would splash it as big as possible on the largest concrete mass possible. But that's just me, and maybe there's reasoning behind the reason we have to be intelligent enough to understand the codes. We have to have enough information of history to understand the codes. I don't have that answer, but there is a key. There is a key.
I think if you look at what Zachariah Sitchin has done with his codes back in, a lot of times it was written in a language which today we don't understand, and so it may have meant a lot more to the local people at that time than it does today. So many, you know, language changes so much, and that it's very difficult to follow even within a couple of hundred years how a word can change. And now you go back 5,000 years, who knows, you know, what the word actually meant.
Yeah. So let's as we wrap up the final 10 here. What do you think the government is hiding about alien abductions, and why do you think they would do that, Ed?
Well, I speculate in my story, and very strongly, that basically they are already communicating with these aliens, and they're getting technology from them, and they're allowing them to continue their research with human beings. Now, if that means they've got to mutilate some cattle, or they got to take somebody hostage, and maybe even have hybrid babies made and stuff like that, our government is willing to do that as long as we don't know that they're doing that in exchange for this information. I think this electronic pulse engine is probably the thing that they're running in Aurora right now, is probably one of those things that they got, along with a lot of other stuff that they got, even as far back as the Roswell crash. See, the Roswell spaceship was also an electronic pulse engine. That's why it crashed. And most people don't realize that in Roswell, that crash in Roswell was caused by an electrical storm that hit the flying saucer and made it drop to the ground. So it was an electronic pulse engine, but it wasn't a government one. It was somebody else's. And that's where they got the idea for this electronic pulse engine, and they've been continuing to work with it and trying to make it work. And I think the aliens are helping them do it. And I think this all started back in 1952 when the flying saucers were over the White House, that they literally forced the government into negotiating with them and allowing them to do what they want. And that's ever since then. I don't know if you've ever had I was in the military, so I've had a classified clearance at one time. And, a long time ago, especially during World War II, if you ask somebody a question and they say, oh, gee, I'm sorry, I can't talk about it, it's classified. Well, when it came to UFOs, if you asked somebody, what about UFOs, and they say, oh, gee, I can't talk about it, it's classified. Well, that tells you that there is something there about that, and that's not what they wanted. They didn't want people to think that the government ever even considered that UFOs were real. So the government changed the classifications, the need to know. They'll lie to you. They say, oh, we don't know what you're talking about. That never happened. I mean, they're still denying that the Area 51 is out there. I mean, that's today. I mean, we got photographs of the thing, and it goes on television, goes on shows.
We have flight manifestos, for goodness sake. I mean, we know the hundreds of people that fly out of Vegas every day. It's not,
met and talked to people who used to work there. I mean, it's there. And they
have their own airline delivery service.
Lying is what the government does, and Eisenhower was the very first president that did it publicly when he went out and said that we don't have any U-2 flights and we didn't spy on Russia. And the very next day, they show Ed Francis Gary Powers and his ship, and Eisenhower had to go out and say, "Oh well, I guess we did," And ever since then, and I believe it started with Harry Truman, but I think ever since then, presidents of the United States, if you ask them a question and it's classified, they don't tell you it's classified. They say, "I don't know what you're talking about." They'll just lie to your face. And I think that's a real problem for a democracy, when you've got a government that's willing to lie to you, even though they think they've got a good reason to. I think that becomes very dangerous, because it puts power in the hands of a very small number of people. And a lot of times those are not the leaders. A lot of times they're just bureaucrats hiding somewhere in some base, maybe in Area 51, that have these secrets and they're not telling anybody about it. And when you ask them about it, they lie to you, and they can get away with it. And I think that's where the danger comes in.
Well, I think the Internet has broken that wide open. They did have the monopoly on information. But now with the dawn of the Internet, I think there's a lot more going on that we know about that we wouldn't have known about before.
Yes, I do. And I think people, you get an opportunity to have people talk to each other and hear different ideas.
Yourself, Ed, who you do have an experience of an alien encounter when you were very young.
Yeah.
This information regarding the trilogy has come through your mind through some very vivid methods. So, the Cosmic Seed Trilogy. It's Foco Enterprises. How do how do the people on board get to the Cosmic Seed? That's thecosmicseed.com. Is that
right? Yeah, thecosmicseed.com is my website. And from there you'll see my, I have a website, I have a telephone number, I'm not hiding, so you can right. always call me on my phone. Site is set up to sell the entire set, the three volumes plus the companion novel. I ship them out, no sales tax and no shipping in the United States. Outside the United States, I have to charge shipping. Most of the international shipping is like $30, and places like Mexico and Canada are like $15.
Right.
But anywhere in the United right. States, it's very inexpensive for me to do it because it weighs less than 4 pounds, and I just absorb the cost. And
right.
my accountant backdates the, because I have to pay sales tax. So, you know, right. but rather than have you add on, you know, $6.87 or something, I just let my accountant backdate it, and you pay one price. It's $80 for the all four books, and
right.
the companion
sounds like
novel,
a good deal.
Yeah, well, the companion novel actually ended up, even though it's not very large, it has all the photographs of all the aliens I use in my story. It has stories, that drawings of the ships and so forth. And when you start hiring artists,
right.
it gets more expensive than hiring writers.
I agree with you 100%.
So,
we have to wind it up tonight, sir. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for taking the time from Bullhead City, Arizona.
Right.
We appreciate you being here, and we wish you much success. And we hope everybody will head over to your website and take advantage of your information that's up there. Because I think there's a lot up there, Ed. More
yeah,
up there than people would realize.
Yeah, I have each story. I've got a brief rundown of every story, and I've got a lot of information about the aliens on there too. So,
excellent.
Okay. And so if they want one, just have them send me an email or purchase it through the website.
There you go. So thecosmicseed.com. Ed Folco, thank you very much for your 90 minutes time, sir. I truly appreciate your time with us tonight.
Okay. And thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Ed, mm-hmm. ladies and gentlemen, Ed Folco, first person abductee, and a very interesting book where he manages to weave the fact of his experiences into the fiction of a book that once you start reading it, you won't want to put it down. It's pretty impressive. It has some twists and turns. It takes you a little while to get used to the characters, and that's why he has a compendium book that comes with the trilogy to kind of help you through the background of the characters so that you can fully enjoy the story that he weaves based on information and reality and some darn good detective investigation work. So thecosmicseed.com. Anyway, that's it. We're at the end of our tether, as they say. It's been an absolute blast. I'm glad that the United States of America made it through another July the 4th, and Canada made it through another July the 1st. It's been an absolute pleasure, ladies and gentlemen. In the meantime, in between time, that's it, that's all. Another edition.
Hey, Night Zoners, got a minute? I'm sure we all know someone who is experiencing difficult times during this recession, either with unemployment or financial problems, or in relationships. I have friends like that. I would like to remind you that we are all in this together. So if you have friends experiencing hardships, support them with your advice. If you have acquaintances who are having rough times, nurture them with your friendship. Show them kindness. If you have family members who are having difficulties, show them your love. And if you have people in your life who have almost given up, throw them a lifeline of kindness. Remember the golden rule, but for the grace of God, go I. Blessings upon your household. Until then, next time we meet.
This has been a Night Zone production in association with Blog Talk. Radio.com.